You're listening to Death of the Reader on 2SER. We are Flex and Herds. This is your Murder Mystery World Tour on 2SER. And Herds, I am ecstatic to say we are at the end of Too Many Cooks.
Look.
And would you look at this?
I know what you're going to say. You get points. You get all the points. Take all of them. Throw them.
I will.
Throw this man's face.
I will take all of these points,
Herds.
All
right, whatever, dude.
Fine.
It is a pleasure to be standing here before you, champion, once again, of this murder mystery game.
It's garbage.
Oh.
Why don't I even do this show? Come on. There is no fair chance. There is no fair play in this mystery.
That's all right. That's all right. Herds, I'll give you the honor of telling us about the novel.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, we're doing Too Many Cooks. This is part three. This is chapters 14 to the end of Too Many Cooks by Rex Stout, featuring Nero Wolfe, our oversized armchair detective.
Yes.
In this part, we will be talking about the final part of the mystery, whether it was fair, whether it wasn't, and all sorts of fun stuff that goes along with that. So strap in for a good time.
Let's get into it. I'm very excited because not only Herds, was this me being proven right once again?
Uh-huh.
I can't take myself seriously being
going.
That narcissistic. I'm sorry.
I know you well. I know you well enough.
So I think that the fantastic thing about this section of the book is that it's so short, but so much happens.
Yes.
Yep. We go through so many different phases of the investigation so quickly, mm-hmm. but none of them catch you blindsided.
Yep. It's a sprint, but it all builds on stuff that we've seen in the past. We're presented with this this cascade of clues and revelations upon clues, and a man who is Saul Panzer, who is apparently from the previous books, and he is nothing if not an exposition machine. He just churns out fact after fact after fact, and this is intentional as well.
Yeah.
This isn't, you know, a poor bit of writing. This isn't, you know, too much information being thrown at us. This is explicitly Nero Wolfe's purpose. After he's exposed Raymond Leggett as our culprit, as our criminal, and he says, "What? You can't pin this on me. What are you trying to do, you sly?" And then he says, "Saul Panzer, please take the stage.
Yes.
Would you speak to Raymond? Speak to Leggett."
It's hard to comment on the role of Saul Panzer because we haven't read the previous novels in the series.
But the impression that we get of him is phenomenal.
Yeah, he seems like the walking summary scene.
Yes.
You know how we have that scene at the end of the novel, which we do get in this one, where the detective sits everyone down and says, "And you were the culprit."
Yeah.
Saul Panzer is that scene with legs.
Yeah, it's excellent. He's a good parallel to Archie Goodwin, who is the literal legs of a detective.
Yes, exactly.
And now we have the legs of the solution. Oh, I love it so much.
And then we also get back to the more, you know, SS Van Dyne clinical detective sort of thing when Nero Wolfe tries to trick, and successfully, mind you, Dina Lassio into unveiling what's happened. Because it's become so obvious through the entire novel that Dina Lassio is involved very closely with the crime.
Yeah.
And the way that Archie and Nero slowly press her to finally confess is a very, very elegantly written passage. Yes.
The psychology of the scene, because we could very easily have just had, you know, Rex out, so could have just said, "Well, the criminals are Dina Lazio and Raymond Leggett, Clapham and Irons, boys," and off they go.
Yeah.
But instead he spins this because we have a character who has done a murder and a character who is an accomplice. And so he presents this dynamic between them that is really only ever off camera before this scene. Dina Lazio is brought to the forefront and you know, Wolf says even, you know, "If you tell us a version of the truth that suits yourself, perhaps, you know, you won't be tried for murder. Perhaps you won't get the ultimate punishment." And she completely falls for it.
Yeah, it's excellent.
Yeah.
And I think it's also a very important thing in the realism of detective fiction to make sure that we actually have a confession of some sort, some evidence that will actually have someone clapped in irons.
Yeah, this is the thing. Raymond doesn't get a chance to because he won't. He won't admit to the crime. He says, even as he's having the handcuffs put on him, he says, "Tolman, this is going to be the end of your career. If you go through with this, that's the end for you." There is a really obvious moment to me. Well, there's a couple of moments where Leggett is showing his guilt, and it's when he's trying to effectively bribe Wolfe.
Yes.
In chapter five, he tries initially to you know, persuade Wolfe to bring Barin onto his staff as a chef, and he'll offer him a commission fee. And And that, you know, that's pretty whatever. That's like background politics of the chefs and whatever is that's happening there. I'm sure it has nothing to do with the murder of the story.
Nothing at all.
But he comes back again and offers Nero Wolfe $50,000 in cash.
$50,000?
In cash.
Is that more than 11,000 francs?
I have no clue. But back in the day, back in the day, I know that this was a lot more than 50,000
because
inflation. This is a huge amount of money in cash. And like, if there was ever a scene to say, I have done a murder, please stop investigating my murder and please focus on this Brynn thing instead, that's the scene.
And this is something I know you love about Murder Mysteries, Herds, is that it was a scene that brilliantly recontextualized a previous scene.
You have me right on the money. I was just about to say that. We have a scene where, you know, Liguette tries to offer an amount of money to the detective to get him to bugger off. He tries to kill the detective, and then he offers even more money. Like, if you put this in a perspective of him as the culprit, that progression of action, the desperation where he's, you know, he's begun with this lie of, I was in New York and, you know, maybe if you help me out here, maybe don't worry about the murder so much. Just get on your train, go home. I know you're only going to be here for 2 days. If I give you a distraction, maybe that'll be fine. But the logical progression that he goes through of getting more and more desperate as time goes on, knowing that he has this time limit that Wolf has even put on himself.
Yeah.
Is exciting to watch.
In the context of the traditional Ronald Knoxian rule that the culprit must be introduced in the early part of the story, technically Liggett fits in.
Technically
Liggett fits in. I wasn't particularly happy with it, but I think that the execution with which his character was presented through the whole of the novel means I am a lot less upset than I otherwise would be about the lack of conventional fair play in this story. Yeah.
Which I'm okay with. As we've said, this is something that Rex Stout was all about.
Yeah.
Pun rhyme intended. He was very much more about the drama and the suspense and the action, the romance. You know, he's an incurable romantic. Less so about the fair play of the detective mystery genre.
Which, you know, as we said on the previous episode, I do have a problem with, but I think that...
I don't. I love it.
Yeah. But I think that going in so close-minded that I can't accept a well-constructed story like this would be foolish.
Sure.
You know, my initial reaction was still like, oh, really, it was the guy that wasn't there at all? But as we got through, and as you say, as we saw that escalation, that brilliant background psychology of characters is one of my favorite parts of background characters in murder mystery, or just stories in general. You know, I know we saw the latest Spider-Man movie, which is a bit of a strange example to bring up, perhaps. And Herds,
you're pandering to me. You're
absolutely loved this one background character.
You're trying to soften the blow from taking my points, but I'm okay with it. Keep going.
Yeah, he absolutely loved this one background character because he was such an excellent parallel for what was going on in the main arc of the story, and it really scaled down and humanized the main complications of the story.
I won't spoil this character or anything about them, but they only have about, I would say, a minute total of functional screen time when they're like the focus, because they just put these little tiny details. They're just snapshots, but they're so punchy and well done. Anyway, this isn't a Spider-Man podcast, but if it was, I give that character 10 out of 10.
I think it's kind of similar to when you look at, you know, model making in movies, and the model makers always put in these tiny details that mean nothing to the audience, but mean a lot to them, and that's what makes the story feel authentic. A lot of these background characters in this novel, even though in the end they don't actually have that much to do with it, all of their emotions are used effectively to convey what is actually going on in the story without demonstrating to you explicitly that it is the core of the story. And I think that is beautiful.
Mm-hmm. None of the chefs actually end up doing the deed, which is kind of funny when we take the premise of there are 15 chefs and one of them dies. Surely it's one of the other chefs. Not at all.
I think if I had to pick a book out of any of the ones that we've covered on this show as the most accessible murder mystery, it would be a very tough call between this one and The Three Taps.
I was going to say The Three Taps has a beautiful sense of humor.
Yeah. And for a lot of the same reasons too. I really think that if you love murder mysteries or if you are not so sure about murder mysteries, this is either the good one to shill out to your friends or an excellent one to get started with.
That said, this one would definitely make the better movie adaptation, which is worth looking into.
Maybe we should. Maybe that's what Death of the Reader can become.
A movie, a murder movie?
Exactly.
We can become a movie murder mystery.
The gimmick just becomes that you and I kill each other every week and make like a 45-minute TV episode about it.
That'd be perfect.
But
can we do that?
The only people on the cast is you and me. Everyone else is just sock puppets.
I think I could do that. I'll be honest. I feel like I had the skill set to do enough terrible voices that we could get away with that.
Yeah, that sounds possible.
I'm playing Wolf, though. I want to say that right now. Nobody can be the larger than life wolf better than me.
Absolutely. I want to be Archie. There's no problems here. This is perfect.
Perfect. We were in agreement
there. We'll see you next week
on TV. I'll see you on set. Let's go.
This is Death of the Reader. We are talking Too Many Cooks by Rex Stout. and we will be back in just a moment. You're listening to Death of the Reader on 2SER. We are Flex and Herds, and today we're joined by Callan Boyes, national food and wine writer for Fairfax, and a food traveller after the heart of our dear Archie Goodwin, our Watson in this murder mystery game this week. Callan, welcome to the show.
Hello.
So, Callan, food is often a matter of passion for us, be it vehemently defending our favourite restaurants or sticking doggedly to the undeniable belief that everyone's mother is the best chef in the world. How can we safely discuss food without incurring a dagger in our back?
Have a very good legal team behind you at the Sydney Morning Herald.
That's a good one.
That's what I find works. I also find it works really, really well to make sure you always say, tastes like, reminds me of.
Mm.
It could be that kind of thing. You don't want to say anything that's too certain. Otherwise, you'll have restaurant legal teams come down you like a ton of bricks. That's if you give negative reviews.
Right.
Which we don't really do that often at, well, I don't say Fairfax Media anymore. Channel 9 is our new overlords. Mm. Or not even Channel 9, just 9.
Ah, this is true.
Yes. Mm-hmm. So it's very rare we do negative reviews because we want to encourage people to go out and eat.
Mm.
If a restaurant's incredibly bad, we just kind of don't write about it. We'd rather celebrate the good than throw shade on the bad. That being said, if something's really calling out for attention, like there was a restaurant today that opened in Melbourne or opened last week, we reviewed it today in Melbourne for The Age, and I think it's just called Pink, the restaurant, and everything's pink.
Uh-huh.
And we scored that. The Melbourne Reviewer scored it 8 out of 20, which has been the lowest score we've done in a Fairfax publication in a long, long time.
Was the meat pink?
I haven't read the review yet. I just saw the score and I clicked and I was like, that'll be when I get home after deadline. I'm going to read that. But there was a lot of horrible looking things in there. Anyway, but look, you just don't be too much of a wanker about it. And at the end of the day, you're talking about food. You're not trying to solve the world's problems. Although some chefs might think they are. So,
well.
Yeah.
Do you often find that that's something that you have to keep in mind when you're writing reviews? Like if you've eaten a dish at a restaurant that you weren't as much of a fan of, will you leave that out of the review if you think it's an outlier or?
Yeah, totally. Look, I've been to a lot of restaurants in Australia many times, and a lot of the best ones, they all have their bad days.
Mm.
The job of a critic is to say, what is this restaurant trying to do and how well do they do it? So if the overall product is pretty bloody good, then that's what you need to talk about. If you've got one waiter that might drop some cutlery or splash some wine on your shirt or something like that, well, you kind of leave that stuff out unless you can tell there's a systemic problem across it. So if one dish is under-seasoned, yeah, maybe you can bring that out and say, well, you know, the tureen probably could have done with more salt.
Mm.
But, yeah, you don't really want to take a whole review down just because, you know, something missed a bit of bloody aioli on the side.
Well, let's say that someone did miss a bit of bloody aioli on the side and then someone is found with a dagger in their back in the kitchen with aioli on it. How do you as a reviewer treat that?
I haven't dealt with too many deaths in the kitchen. Well, no, I haven't. I can't remember the last time a Sydney chef was murdered in their restaurant.
No chefs have come after you wielding their kitchen knives, their steak knives, trying to hunt you down for giving a bad review. No, nothing like that.
No, I'm usually pretty good. And but I've definitely had some shade thrown at me online every now and again. I remember the time I've most got in trouble off Sydney's chef community when I said the third best chicken sandwich in Sydney was the Zinger at KFC.
Oh, no.
That's
bad. And I stand by it. I think I still stand by that claim today. I haven't gone out and tested a lot of chicken sandwiches in the last 2 or 3 years since I wrote that. But, you know, there was a dour time there for chicken burgers, chicken sandwiches in Sydney. And that was kind of the best. It was like, why can a 15-year-old kid make a better bloody chicken sandwich than half the chefs in Sydney? And I say chicken sandwich because I believe that a burger needs to have meat on it. Ground beef, that's it.
Mm-hmm.
Anything else is a sandwich. And I know I sound like a wanker saying that, and I apologize.
That's all right. You're a food writer. That's the job. Now, you mentioned kind of the egos of some chefs and how you scarred them with KFC. Too Many Cooks, our book this week, is full to the brim with foodie egos from Rex Stout's 15 Masters of the Cooking World. Is the food world overflowing with such egos, or is it just a thing of the past, or was it just a concoction of our author this week, Rex Stout?
No, there is a lot of egos out there. They're getting better at hiring marketing and PR departments to kind of tell them what to do when they talk to people like me. But I still hear some pretty heinous stories from behind the chef's line of what goes on in kitchens. But look, it's probably better. It definitely is better than what it was 5 or 10 years ago. Definitely better than it was 20 years ago, 30 years ago. Mm. That boys' culture, that brigade culture is slowly coming out of kitchens. But look, it's still certainly there and in a lot of places. But look, you've got open kitchens now in a lot of places. That was never really a thing, say, 25 years ago. So you've really got to learn to respect your staff and kind of put your ego away and just talk to people in a nice, calm, serene manner about what they might be doing wrong and then give them a good bollocking after service instead when the customers have gone home. But look, I mean, with chefs and ego these days, social media has opened up a whole bunch of opportunities to get out there and see what people are doing and learn from that and say like, oh, okay, well, I've been doing it this way for such a long time. Ah, this guy in like Copenhagen or this guy in Brazil or wherever it might be, which I had no access to that before. And I can currently see what's happening in real time in those restaurants all around the world. I think that's great to kind of dig bits and pieces of influence.
Yeah.
Without stealing dishes. That's one thing that chefs do get quite upset about.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Is if you steal a dish, like blatantly, and I am damn sure that there is a number of chefs, and I won't name them, in Australia that go through like cookbooks from like weird Scandinavian countries and that kind of thing and just kind of like take, you know, bits and pieces here and there and think no one's ever going to know.
Yeah. I mean, that's just like one of the main chefs in our story. Jerome Berin goes to great lengths to defend his recipe for, are you going to try to pronounce this one, Herds?
Saucisse minuit.
Yeah.
I hope.
Hey, you've practiced.
I have. I've been learning since the first episode, my friend.
That's great.
How was I out of 10?
You're about 9.5, sir.
So. Oh, that's the highest praise I can ask for.
Yeah.
It's beautiful.
No, you go. Yeah, no, you're right. One of the things, though, I tell you what, I mean, because you don't deal with chefs in restaurants too often when it comes to ego, waiter ego, that's an issue. Ooh. And pronunciation is my big pet peeve. You know, it's when you, and especially wine. Like if I went with my dad and he's like, you know, he feels a bit like nervous and anxious being in a restaurant and he asks for the cabinet, say, instead of cabinet. And then you've got the waiter that comes back to him and says, ah, yes, the cabinet, sir. And then dad's with his family. He feels embarrassed and it's just not good. And, you know, I write about this all the time, but it still keeps happening. And so food pronunciation, especially French restaurants, but Chinese, everything, like it can be pretty bloody hard. So I think a good waiter should not want to had that almost narcissistic streak to show like, oh, this is how you actually pronounce it.
Is there any recipe these days that chefs are trying to crack that one restaurant in the past has had or one that has kind of been lost to the annals of history that they're trying to bring back?
Oh, no, great question. Not that I'm aware of. I think we're really pushing the food to its 10th degree now and the whole... I think what we're trying to do now and what I'm noticing, which is great, is with Australian ingredients. We're a very young country in terms of post-colonial cooking. And, you know, Aboriginal cultures for years knew how to utilize these ingredients and manipulate them for taste. And now we're just rediscovering all that kind of stuff now. So, like, that's where experimentation is going. So the world of Australian ingredients is really, really interesting. So people trying to make those ingredients as tasty as they possibly can, that's what's fascinating. Because you can't just pick up some Davidson plum or a bunion nut and it's going to be delicious instantaneously. You've really got to work a little bit hard to crack that. So, yeah, that's what I'm seeing a lot of. Yeah, but I think hopefully that whole idea of that fat duck style molecular gastronomy thing and that's going away these days, thankfully.
Thankfully.
Yeah, it's just all about sourcing good produce and then what can you do to it to make it taste the most like itself, really, and bring out its best. And yeah.
Well, all right, Callan, thank you so much for joining us here on Death of the Reader. If you want to catch any of Callan's food writing, you can catch him in Nine's publications, such as at goodfood.com.au, for those of you who aren't getting the newspapers here in Australia. Callan, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much.
And we'll be back with Rex Stout's Too Many Cooks in just a second. You're listening to Death of the Reader. We are Flex and Herds. This is, pause for effect, your murder mystery world tour.
You're allowed to get away with that? Can we pause on radio?
I think we can.
I think we kicked off if we pause for too long.
I think if we pause for, yeah, if we pause for too long, they just start playing music over the top of us.
Which we don't want. So let's not make it too long of a pause.
Yeah.
In fact, if we just say the word pause instead, I feel like that. Yeah. Anyway, Murder Mystery World Tour, we're talking about Too Many Cooks. This is the absolute final part of the final episode.
Yes.
We'd like to thank you for joining us. Talk about fair play.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We've spoken the whole way through this book about fair play and the fact that Rex Stout was not a proponent of conventional fair play.
Mm.
And as always, if you want to know about the conventional rules of fair play in the detective fiction genre, you can catch that on the podcast online. Mm-hmm. Just search for Extra.
Yep. Talking about Knox's rules, talking about Van Dyne's rules, all that fun stuff. Making sure that the reader has the proper tools to solve the mystery for themselves.
But Rex Stout has no such concern, it seems.
No, he doesn't care. He doesn't care. He'd rather make a good story, which I am okay with.
So, is this story fair? I would give this, if I was to rate it on a scale of fairness from, you know, 1 to 10, I would give it a 6. It's okay. Above average,
yeah. But
it's not stellar in terms of its fairness. And, okay, I think, Herds, that...
Yeah.
I think that this story has perhaps swayed my heart a little bit. I thought, going into this, when we got to the end of chapter 6, that I was done for. I thought that we had abandoned fair play.
We were.
I thought that there was no culprit in sight, because it didn't feel like anyone was particularly suspicious.
No.
But then Alberto Malfi came out of nowhere, out of seemingly nowhere, out of literally nowhere.
You're right. He doesn't have any business being in that scene except to say, what about the Zalotta guy? And it's like, who's Zalotta? Well, he was mentioned at the first part of the novel. He might be important. No.
No.
He's a red herring.
You know, if we look back at all of the clues, for example, as I stated in the previous episode, I said that if you look at all of the people that had motive presented in chapters 1 to 6, all of the people that had motive to kill Philip Lazio were, you know, all disconnected. None of them really seemed weightier than one or the other. But the only person that tied them all together, other than Philip Lazio himself, was Raymond Liggett as the owner of Philip Lazio's workplace.
Yeah, for sure. I do think that you could very easily make this a proper fair play mystery.
Yeah.
I think that all you would really need to do is, barring, you know, change the narrative yourself, but you could set it from the perspective of Nero Wolfe. Mm. I think that would be very easy. A lot of the clues that we kind of talk about in the later chapters are things that Nero Wolfe was aware of or was suspecting way back when. You know, he says, you know, this is something that Raymond Liggett said. This is when he talked about the source print temps, which was not mentioned in the newspapers.
What a ridiculous clue that was.
Exactly. Because it's not an obvious one. It's a hand wave remark.
Yeah.
It's something that Nero Wolfe apparently, you know, draws attention to in his mind, but we're never really discussed on camera, so to speak, in the pages of the novel. And he gets confirmation of it when he has his telegram come over, which is also not explained to us.
Yeah.
The easiest way to make this fair play and also to follow the rules that we've kind of been looking at in the previous novels would be to say, here is Nerval's process. He tells Archie, you know, this is why I sent this telegram. This is what the telegram says, because it's in code. And codes are kind of weird in murder mystery novels when you're not supposed to kind of solve them.
But Archie is such an entertaining perspective that I don't mind at all.
No, for sure.
Nero Wolfe sitting in an armchair thinking about things for 17 chapters would be excruciating.
I would be very interested, actually, in reading a novel which is purely set from the perspective of an armchair detective who never leaves the room, and the clues are like, I heard a gunshot. Something like flew past, like a newspaper flies past the window, like covered in egg yolk. And they're trying to like figure out based on these, you know, visual and auditory stimuli that they get within the room.
Mm.
Of course, that would be very silly. We should find that novel.
Maybe we should. Yeah. But, you know, I think going back to the source print temps, it goes very much back to murder mystery short stories, where a lot of murder mystery short stories have what are nearly grammatical clues.
Yes.
This one, the main clue that Nero Wolfe banks on is the fact that Raymond Liggett supposedly couldn't have found out that it was source print temps that they had to taste.
Even though, like, the novel tells us that he went straight to Wolfe, but There are people that you pass on the way through a spa
Let's be fair here.
Yeah.
He also supposedly wasn't in the town.
Yes.
The day that the crime happened.
Yes. Yes.
But that was a lie as well. So it's not exactly as strong evidence as Nero Wolfe makes it out to be.
Mm.
But I think that we as the reader can see why it's stronger than it might actually be in situ.
And of course, this is all in service of building the suspense and making it so that Nero Wolfe's grand scene where he exposits and tells us all about who the culprit is and how he figured it out, it makes it that much more interesting.
Yeah.
And that's the balance, of course, is writing a murder mystery where we can appreciate the talent of the detective and they don't feel insufferable, you know, finding that balance there, which is a bit tricky for some authors. Anyway, for one author maybe. But finding that balance between a detective who tells everything to the audience, but they can figure out who the killer is, but they just won't tell anyone explicitly who it is, you know. Finding that balance between suspense and annoyance, I think, is very very difficult.
Yeah.
And this novel does sacrifice some of that fair play in order for Nero Wolfe to be a little bit smarter and for us to be in the dark a little bit longer.
I think that one of the other most important aspects to consider about this novel is that it's not the first one in its series. It isn't necessary for these authors to actually go through and make each story accessible as its own. I know that one of our listeners has actually complained to me that Agatha Christie is particularly guilty of spoiling her own stories in later books in her own series.
Yeah.
Which is one of the difficulties with getting into her stories. And I think Sir Arthur Conan Doyle does that as well, but it's been a while since I've been over that, so I can't say for sure on that front. But, you know, I think that there is a certain value to the completely isolated serialized stories like this, where I'm sure if you were a well-read Rex Stout fan, you would be able to spot hints and jokes about past books in this one. But at the same time, the fact that you were able to jump in anywhere in the series and have such a good time like we did with this novel is excellent.
Yeah, finding something of value in a long series like this it's incredibly valuable. It's like if you were to jump into a long book series, or I should say a series with a lot of long books like The Lord of the Rings or Frank Herbert's Dune, series like that, you would have a hard time getting into the characters.
Yeah.
You know, if you didn't read Fellowship of the Ring, you'd be like, what's this ring doing here? Who are the orcs?
And of course, one of the challenges for us is that we have to find the books that do fulfill that role, where we can say, you know, this is the book we're covering for the next 3 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
This is what we think you can do. If we jump into the middle of a series and they spoil the previous 6 books in the series in the opening.
Or somebody else's series.
Yeah.
Van Dyne. Looking at you, sir.
Still upset about that.
His ghost will haunt us.
His ghost continues to haunt me. But yeah, Herds, I think it's pretty obvious from what we've been talking about that this story, it's not completely fair, but it's also not what matters.
I mean, look,
that's all right.
I know this will surprise many people, but even I had picked out who the culprit was. You know, I couldn't quite figure it out.
Who do you think it was?
Look, I might have thought it was Malfi.
That's fair.
Because he runs around and he talks to people and he's like, oh, it was Zoltar or whatever his name was. Zolotta, that's his name.
He does seem very evil.
I mean, yeah, just the way that he's running around and they talk about Corsican stabbing each other. And he's an actual active participant in the story. You know?
Yeah.
He shows up out of nowhere, but he's just a henchman.
No, absolutely. I can sympathize with that choice. I nearly made that foolish error myself, Herds.
Yeah.
But fortunately, I survived in the end.
That's all right. Maybe the next novel, I'll have better luck. Flex, you want to tell us about the next book?
Yeah, Herds. I'm very excited for this one.
Why so?
We are finally escaping the golden age of murder mystery.
Yay, what country are we going to?
We're going halfway between America and Russia.
What does that even mean?
It's an American author who's from Russia.
That's amazing. Where's this novel set? Tell us about it.
The future, Herds.
The future? Oh, it's not a where, it's a when.
Yes.
Oh, I'm so excited.
Herds, you might have heard of this arguably iconic author by the name of Isaac Asimov.
That's the robot guy.
That's the robot guy.
My goodness. What?
Yeah. The three laws of robotics themselves will be the next set of rules that we'll be covering on this show.
Okay, I'm down for that.
As we delve in to Isaac Asimov's 1954 novel, The Caves of Steel.
The Caves of Steel?
Yes.
Are we going to space?
We will be going kind of to space. We have a robot. We have a robot detective. We have a human detective. We'll be covering chapters 1-6 and Herds. I am so excited to delve into sci-fi murder mystery.
I'm so ready. I love sci-fi.
This has been Death of the Reader. We hope you've enjoyed Too Many Cooks by Rex Stout as much as we did.
We'll see you next week.